Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting of the Senate Education Committee to order. It is 3:30 p.m. here on Monday, April 17th. We are in the Belts Committee Room of State Capitol Building in Juneau. I hope everyone had a lovely Folk Fest weekend. I'm going to ask folks to be mindful of their cell phones and to ensure that they keep the conversations to a minimum in the background. Joining me today is Senator Keel, Senator Gray Jackson, myself, Senator Tobin, and we have President Stevens is absent today on state business. Joining us now is also Senator Bjorkman. Thanks again to the wonderful and ever amazing Sydney, who is moderating today's meeting, and Mary Gwen holding down the fort in recording and documenting the meeting today for records. On the agenda today is the consideration of Senator Willikowski's Senate Bill 99 to require financial literacy courses in Alaska's public schools. We will also be receiving a presentation from the Alaska Department of Health on the Parents as Teachers program, a program that is near and dear to my heart as it is part of the Alaska Reads Act. And also we'll be receiving a presentation from the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development on special education here in the state of Alaska. All of the documents for today's meetings are available on BASIS or in the smorgasbord of paper and plethora of dead trees by the door. Up first is Senate Bill 99, Financial Literacy in Schools. I believe we have Senator Willikowski here to provide a quick overview. But first, before we get to that point, we're going to adopt a new committee substitute. That committee substitute should be in folks' packets. And I'm going to ask Senator Willikowski's staffer, Kaylee Spencer, to provide an overview of the changes.
All right. Thank you, through the chair.
Really quickly, do we need to adopt? We need to move. I apologize for that. A little bit out of order. Senator Keel, may I have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 99, work draft 33LS0498/U as in Unalakleet as our working document.
I'm going to object for purpose of the explanation of changes and ask Ms. Spencer to do so.
All right. Thank you. Through the chair, for the record, my name is Kaylee Spencer, Senator Willikowski's office, Senate District K. As mentioned, I'll be going over an explanation of the changes from version S to version U, and then see if there are any questions. Just to start, all of these changes happen underneath Section 1 of Alaska Statute 14.30, the first one being on page 1, lines 7 through 11. It removes one half credit hour of financial literacy education course approved by the department and adds financial literacy education program approved by the department. A school district may provide the program through one or more courses offered by the school district, but the program's hours of instruction must be, in the aggregate, be equivalent to one half credit hour course. This change allows school districts to implement a financial literacy program that can be spread across multiple courses or incorporated into pre-existing courses if the program's total hours of instruction are equivalent to one half credit hour course. This change does not prevent districts from still implementing that financial literacy course that's one half credit just on its own. This just provides a little more flexibility for districts. The next change happens on page 1, line 13, and adds to the maximum extent practicable. This change just makes it so that school districts are required to incorporate discussion or instruction on requirements listed to the effect that's feasible or effective for that district specifically. The next change happens on pages 1 and 2, lines 14 through 1, and it removes bank accounts and opening and managing a bank account and adds financial institutions and opening and managing an account with a financial institution. This change allows school districts to include discussion or instruction on multiple different types of financial institutions and their accounts. The next change is on page 2, lines 8 through 9, and adds predatory lending practices. This change allows school districts to include discussion or instruction on predatory lending practices. The next change is on page 2, lines 17 through 20, and adds financial implications of being a member or a beneficiary of a Native corporation established under 43 U.S. Code 1601 and what follows relating to the Alaska Native Claims and Settlements Act or a similar entity, including payment of dividends and issuance of shares. This change allows school districts to include discussion or instruction on the financial implications of being a member or a beneficiary of a Native corporation or a similar entity. And that concludes the changes.
Thank you very much, Ms. Spencer. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing no questions, I remove my objection. And without objection, work order 33-LS0498-U is adopted as our working document. Version U of the Senate Bill 99 is now before the committee. Any final questions or comments for the bill sponsor or his aide? Seeing none, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the Education Committee report Senate Bill 99, work order 33-LS0498-U as in Unalakleet, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Without objection, Senate Bill 99, work order 33-LS0498-U is reported from the Senate Education Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Thank you so much. And we're back on the record here in Senate Education. It is Monday, April 17th, here in the Belts Committee Room, and we are about to hear a titillating presentation from the Alaska Department of Health regarding the Parents as Teachers program. Joining us today, we have Emily Urlacher, Public Health Specialist 2. She's backed up by her dynamic duo of Mac Wood, Public Health Informationist 2, and Christine Reinhart, Health Program Manager 2. All three, I believe, are on Teams and ready to present here in Senate Education. If you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation when you're ready, and please just let Mike know that you need the slide advance, and he will do so.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Emily Urlacher. I work with the State of Alaska Department of Health, Division of Public Health, as the Parents as Teachers Program Manager. I have two colleagues here with me today, and I will let them introduce themselves. Mac?
Hi, for the record, my name is Mac Wood. I'm a public health informaticist with the Division of Public Health.
And for the record, my name is Christy Reinhart. I'm with the Division of Public Health. I'm the Perinatal and Early Childhood Unit Manager and the Maternal Infant Early Childhood Home Visiting, or MCV, Program Manager.
Next slide, please.
So for the record, I'm Christy Reinhart, and as I mentioned, I'm the Perinatal Early Childhood Unit Manager, and I'm also the federally funded McVie Program Manager. So the purpose of home visiting is to provide training and support to clients who are pregnant or have young children with a goal of improved maternal and child health, safer homes, and school and improved school readiness. Now, Congress created McVie in 2010, and it was reauthorized just this past December. There's been a McVie program in Alaska since 2012. In addition to managing a nurse-based program at Providence Hospital, McVie is also tasked with providing support, collaboration, professional development for home visiting across all states. So our program helps with that coordination of programs and helps align the McVie program with other early childhood home visiting programs and in maternal child initiatives. With McVie funds, we're able to share information via our home visiting listserv, training through our home visiting echo series, and we put on an annual summit for all home visitors as well as infant learning program providers across the state. Parents as Teachers is actively involved in all of this work that we do for professional development and elevating the field. And not only do we share these training opportunities and collaboration, we also share Mac Wood, who is the data analyst for both the McVie and the State Parents as Teachers program. Thank you.
For the record, this is Emily Erlacher. Next slide, please. Actually, I believe you're on it. It's kind of hard to see which slide you are on, but I believe we are where we should be. So with this information in mind, I'm going to move us directly into our presentation specific to the State of Alaska Parents as Teachers Home Visiting Program. On a more fun side note, all of the pictures you see in our slides are of Alaska families who have or are currently participating in this program in our state. Next slide, please. So what is Parents as Teachers? It is a voluntary, evidence-based home visiting model that promotes the optimal early development, learning, and health of children by supporting and engaging their parents and caregivers. The program model can be offered prenatally through kindergarten and is replicated nationwide by various types of organizations. The program is administered by Parents as Teachers educators, who are home visiting professionals who meet families where they are most comfortable, typically in the home. During visits, parent educators assess family needs and partner with families to set goals. Parent educators provide necessary information and resources to ensure that families are confident in the emotional, behavioral, and physical development of their children. Next slide, please. I'm having difficulty seeing the slide. Do you see a picture of a family planting seeds?
We do. We are on slide 5.
Thank you very much. There are three types of Parents as Teachers programs found in Alaska. The first is subscribers. Those are found all over, and those are programs that use the Parents as Teachers curriculum within their program, but they do not have to report fidelity to the model, which is to Parents as Teachers National. They can pick and choose what they want from the curriculum. And the second type of Parents as Teachers user is partners. And this is specific to early Head Start and Head Start programs using Parents as Teachers curriculum. They have the option to become a curriculum partner. This allows them to better align the Parents as Teachers program with national Head Start performance standards. And finally, we have Parents as Teachers affiliates, which are the organizations whose home visiting programs are designed to implement the Parents as Teachers model to full fidelity. Mandatory training and rigorous annual reporting requirements by all participating affiliates make it the only Parents as Teachers option that is considered evidence-based. All of our Parents as Teachers grantees are required to be affiliates in good standing. Next slide, please.
Excuse me, Ms. Erlacher, before we skip to the next slide, may I ask in each of these categories, subscriber, partners, and affiliates, how many participants do we have in each category?
To the chair, thank you for your question. We will have to follow up on that. Currently, we only track Parents as Teachers grantees. or affiliate programs.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Back to parents as teachers as an evidence-based model, there are four model components and seven primary goals. The first component of the model is personal visits. When the parent educator comes into the home to deliver personalized services, there are three things or three parts of a visit that a parent educator does with the family. And the first is a developmentally appropriate parent-child activity. The second is time for a developmental-centered parenting information time. So this could be a discussion, it could be an activity. It depends on the curriculum and what they're discussing at the time. And the third is family well-being. The second component is group connections, and that's when all the participating families in the program come together for social connection, support, and learning. It is a requirement that each affiliate program host at least 12 group connections a year. The third is resource network, which means the parent educators work closely with the family to connect them to identified resources. This could be something like WIC, a pediatrician, early intervention programming, and other community services. And the fourth component is child screening, and screening includes developmental screening, health screening, parent-child interaction, postpartum depression, and more. I'm not going to go through each of the seven primary goals, but I did add an asterisk to prevent child abuse and neglect because I think it's really important to highlight this one. Parents as Teachers is noted in the Title IV-E Prevention Services Clearinghouse as a well-supported model. This is the highest rating. That means the Administration for Children and Families within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services recognizes parents as teachers is evidence-based and in accordance with the Family First Prevention Services Act. This is why we have recently partnered with the Office of Children's Services to expand parents as teachers, and I'll review that partnership in a little bit more detail later in the presentation. Next slide, please. I mentioned earlier that all State of Alaska Parents as Teachers grantees must maintain affiliate status. The visual on this slide is a representation of the process to become and maintain an affiliate. I'm not going to go into details of each tier today, but in summary, these requirements are in place so that Parents as Teachers National can monitor program outcomes and continue to provide data that supports their status as a well-supported, evidence-based home visiting program. Next slide, please. So, who are these parent educators who are serving Alaska families? At minimum, they must have a high school diploma, although most parent educators have at least a two-year degree. Many of our parent educators also have lived experience, which helps them better connect with the families they serve. As mentioned in the previous slide, they are well-trained individuals in the Parents as Teachers curriculum and service delivery model. And finally, a parent educator's caseload is determined by two things, experience and family need. For experience, first-year parent educators complete no more than 48 visits per month, while those with two or more years of experience may complete no more than 60 visits a month. Caseload is also determined by family need, which I'll address on this next slide. Families with greater need for support by parent educators are entitled to more visits. The need is determined through a Parents as Teachers Family Information Record form, which is filled out by the family during enrollment. Families are asked to indicate what we call stressors that they have had or are currently experiencing. I've included a list of examples for your review. It is not exhaustive. Families who indicate one or fewer stressors receive at least 12 personal visits annually. Those who indicate two or more stressors receive at least 24 personal visits annually. Next slide, please. So who are the State of Alaska Parents as Teachers grantees and where are they serving families? Currently, we have four. We have Kids Corps Incorporated in Anchorage, Alaska Family Services in Matsu Valley, the Association for the Education of Young Children Southeast in Juneau, and Rural CAP is our fourth. They currently have parent educators in Kodiak, Haines, Tuxuk Bay, and Anchorage. Outside of the State of Alaska grantees, there are two federally funded tribal Parents as Teachers affiliate programs. The first is Cook Inlet Tribal Council. The second is Fairbanks Native Association. And now I'm going to ask my colleague, Mac Wood, to share some state fiscal year 2022 service delivery data points for you.
Hi, for the record, this is Mac Wood, public health informaticist. So I'm going to dig into some of the service delivery and performance data. We're looking at fiscal year 22 as it's the most current complete data that we have available right now. So starting off looking at capacity, we're funded for 146 families, but we actually served a little bit more than that in FY22. So 166 families were served, and in those families, 209 children were served. So at the per grantee level, ranges from 13 to 101 families per grantee and between 19 and 129 children per grantee. Those grantees completed 1,569 home visits with those families, and they hosted group activities with a sum of participants of 4,369. Two-thirds of families experienced between zero and one family stressor, and the remaining third experienced two or more. Just under 60% of families had an income less than 200% of the federal poverty level. And if we could get the next slide. I'm now going to jump into some performance data. So 89% of parents read, sang songs, or told stories to their children daily. This is an early childhood pre-literacy measure. And comparing to our MCV counterpart, their similar performance measure was at 85%, so pretty close. 152 children had an ages and stages questionnaire developmental screening that were completed. Those screenings resulted in 11 referrals to services being made. And on this measure, we're also pretty close to MCV. So 89% of the PAT children met that measure and 85% of the MCV children. 150 children with hearing and vision screenings were completed. And one hearing and three vision referrals to services were made following those screenings. 144 children had a caregiver-child interaction assessment completed. This one, PAT, performed much better than the MCV counterpart, so we came in at 69%, while MCV 24% met their similar measure. Families were linked to 101 unique community organizations across the state, and they hosted 75 group activities with attendance of over 4,000. Next slide, please. So now I'm going to jump into some of the program cost data. There was a total funding amount in FY22 of $474,700. $434,000 of that went directly to the grantees. Between $60,000 and $145,000 were the awards for each grantee, and most of those grant costs go directly to personnel, about 80% nationally in the PAT model. Looking at average costs for family and child service delivery, in Alaska, the average PAT costs for families were about $2,600. And then per child served was just under $2,100. This cost does vary quite a bit depending on the area in which the family is served and also the amount of family stressors identified as that relates to the amount of visits received. Comparing that to some national PAT data, the national PAT cost per family ranges between $4,000 and $6,500. And a national average cost per child between $1,150 and $3,650. And with that, I'll pass it back to Emily.
Thank you. Next slide, please. It should read fiscal year 2023 delivery. For the record, this is Emily Erlacher. This year was very exciting because we initiated a partnership with the Office of Children's Services to provide program expansion funds to two of our grantees through a funding blend of Family First Transition Funds and Community-Based Child Abuse Prevention, or CBCAP, grant funds. Through this expansion, we were able to serve families in Tuxedo Bay, serve more families on the wait list with the Parents as Teachers program in Juneau, and serve additional families with more identified stressors in Anchorage. Data from this state fiscal year 2023 will be available after July 30th. It's also important and exciting to note that funding from the Office of Children's Services this year also went to provide support for statewide expansion of Parents as Teachers affiliate programs by paying for the required Parents as Teachers national training for new staff or for programs intending to become affiliates. Next slide, please.
We have a question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned serving more families off the current wait list. Can you sort of orient us roughly what are the sizes of the wait lists in the communities we're able to serve?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Keel, for your question. Currently, AEYC Southeast, located in Juneau where you are, has maintained a wait list. It does fluctuate. Funding was given to them to serve more families. At the time that we were in discussion for expansion, they had reported 60 additional families on that wait list. Oh. At any given time, the wait list may change for each program. Currently, KCI, so Kids Corps Incorporated in Anchorage, has 12 families on a wait list. And I'm unsure of the other two, but I can find out for you.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to fiscal years 2024 through 2026. This is our next three-year grant cycle for the Parents as Teachers program. We are excited to share that the request for proposals went out late this winter, and we have received multiple responses. The programmatic requirements from the Alaska Reads Act on Parents as Teachers supports implementation at the affiliate level, which we're already doing. So by ensuring grantees maintain the affiliate status, we can meet the requirements of the Act. We will be able to demonstrate this by requiring additional data from the grantees than we did before, and my colleague McWood will explain these exciting changes in the next few slides. It's also pretty exciting to announce that through the preschool development grant renewal, we will also have funding to reinstate the Parents as Teachers state office, which will provide training and technical assistance to all Parents as Teachers programs in Alaska, regardless of program status. So subscribers, partners, affiliates, all Parents as Teachers programs receive additional support. And I will pass it back to Mac. Thank you.
For the record, this is Mac Wood, public health informaticist. So now I'm going to touch on some evaluation work that we have done so far and some next steps moving forward. So to date, we have linked 189 of 592 PAT served children born between 2009 to 2021 to DEED education records. And 123 of the 189 that we linked had non-missing Alaska Developmental Profile, ADP, assessment results. This ADP is assessed upon entry to school based on teacher observations. And so with this linked data, we intend to identify aspects of the PAT program that are performing well and which areas need improvement specific to educational outcomes. This will inform program implementation to focus limited resources where they are most efficient to have the greatest impacts. To control for possible bias and ensure participants in the PAT group were not statistically different than the comparison group, we used a quasi-experimental matching process. Unfortunately, with the small sample size we currently have, there aren't enough data yet to confidently complete that full, robust analysis. Instead, we completed a preliminary summary analysis comparing outcomes within the PAT participant group with a comparison group of children represented in the Alaska Childhood Understanding Behaviors Survey, CUBS, using stressor data that we have for both families. And so to highlight some of those highlights of that analysis, 45% of the Juneau PAT children met the DEED ADP standard versus 36% of the comparison group. 28% of all PAT children in households with low educational attainment met the standard versus only 11% in that comparison group. And the PAT children did underperform in households with a single parent and with first-time parents. And so this kind of points to an opportunity for targeted quality improvement projects. Next slide, please. So now kind of some evaluation next steps, what we've got planned for the future. So we'll be annually linking additional data submitted by grantees to administrative records to expand our evaluation data set. We're going to add discipline records and third and fourth grade reading scores from DEED into that same research data set. And we're also going to be linking child maltreatment records from the Office of Children's Services. We'll then reassess program effects using the quasi-experimental, that more robust evaluation as sample size increases. And we're also going to be aligning grantee screening assessment tools through the next iteration of the implementation of the grant, which will allow for program-wide evaluation of some outcomes that we can't capture through those administrative data linkages, such as parental involvement, child health, and development outcomes. And all of these efforts collectively will satisfy the evaluation required by the Alaska Needs Act. And with that, I'll hand it back over to Emily to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Any questions from committee members? Seeing no questions, I want to thank you again for this presentation, and I'm looking forward to hearing updates as you continue to expand and implement some of these new program evaluation steps.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We will now hear a presentation from the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development about special education in Alaska. Joining us today are Elwin Blackwell, the DEED School Finance Manager, and Donald Enoch, State Special Education Administrator, who I believe is on Teams. Welcome once again to Senate Education. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation when you are ready.
Yes, for the record, this is Elwin Blackwell, School Finance Manager at the Department of Education and Early Development. And today we're going to go through a special education presentation, doing some funding and other information about the special ed programs up there. First off, as you have seen through the other presentations from the department, we have a mission, vision, and purpose. We are always striving for an excellent education for every student every day. And our vision is provided to us in statute. So the legislature provided our vision years ago. And we exist to provide information, resources, and leadership to support an excellent education for every student every day. These are our five shared priorities. I won't read through them. I'm sure you've heard them multiple times now. Our agenda today, we're going to go through some funding for special education, do a quick overview of the intensive funding, and then we will go through some special education specific questions that will be addressed, special education teacher skills, and then support direct support for low incident disabilities. I know the committee went through the foundation formula several weeks back, but we will go through the relevant pieces of that foundation formula to talk about the funding that is specifically in there for special education services. Within the current state foundation formula, for a special needs student to be, this is the eligibility for children with disabilities. So a child with an active individualized education program, which is an IEP, they may attend school if at the age of 3 or if under the age of 22 by July 1st. Special needs funding, this multiplier that's in the formula, is funding to include special education, vocational education, gifted, talented, and bilingual, bicultural. It is a block grant funding at 20%, so it's just a multiplier within the foundation formula to help provide additional resources to cover those types of activities that a district may have. Special needs funding applies to all students except for correspondence program students, as it's currently in statute. So for intensive needs services, for a student to be eligible, a district to receive the funding, a district has to be providing the services, The student has to be enrolled on the last day of the 20-day or 20-school-day count period, and they must meet the intensive qualifications for each intensive service student. And I'm sure Mr. Enoch will go over some of those requirements as he gets in there. Eligible intensive needs or intensive services students, we will multiply them by a factor of 13, and then that will be added back into our student counts as they move through for funding. So an intensive needs student will generate about $77,400 under our current base student allocation. All intensive services students receive foundation funding. Even including correspondence program students, if an intensive needs student is identified within correspondence, they will be included in that count and the district would receive that funding. And at this point, I am going to hand this over to Mr. Enoch to start going over the rest of these slides, and I will advance them for him.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Don Enoch. I'm the State Administrator for Special Education. We were asked some specific questions to be addressed, and they were student count related. And we have the special education student count at 19,391 students. That is for the 23-24 school year. Of those students, 3,243 are intensive students. The total state count currently is 130,733 students. This information will be updated on the website shortly. Next slide, please. Another question we were asked is what type of special skills, tools, and curricula students need to be served in special education. Essentially, the skill set varies from student to student, but all students have to receive the education that they need to be provided FAPE. This can vary significantly, but all special education teachers require teacher certification. Next slide, please. Some of the special education teacher skills that we're identifying are seven of them. Knowledge of special education laws and regulations. I won't read the details there below because they're pretty straightforward and obvious, but I will add to knowledge of special education laws and regulations does include policies and procedures at the local district level as well. In differentiated instruction, special education teachers need to have multiple skill sets for teaching different students with different types of disabilities from different approaches. Some of the typical examples include autism spectrum disorders, learning disabled students, and students with other developmental disabilities. Also, classroom management skills are key. Students with special needs requiring those unique skills, they should be in structured and supportive environments that encourages participation and maximizes distraction. Next slide, please. Collaboration is exceedingly important, especially in our current post-COVID time. Teachers need to work together and collaborate with each other. Additionally, special education teachers should be collaborating with speech therapists, occupational therapists, physical therapists, school psychologists, and other related service providers. Assistive technology is growing in leaps and bounds every year. It's amazing some of the things that are coming out now for students. These assistive technology devices can help students overcome barriers to their learning problems. Teachers should be familiar with a variety of technology tools such as text-to-speech software, speech recognition software, and adaptive computer input devices. A nice example that has come a long way in the last few years is the Eagle Eye software, which allows a student that is nonverbal and non-mobile to be able to look with eye gaze at a computer screen and click on things with motions in the eye. This software was well over $5,000 a few years ago, and now it's dropped into literally the $1,000 range. Also, a very detailed knowledge of individualized education programs, the IEPs, that's the backbone of special education paperwork. Teachers must be competent in this area, and thanks to the legislature, now all school districts use an electronic-based system that is online. That helps them write these IEPs, which can be substantially difficult, especially for newer teachers who are not familiar with the process. Using the online system reduces the incident of noncompliance, and it increases the accuracy of student services. And finally, specialized curricula. Teachers should also be knowledgeable about specialized curricula and instructional strategies designed for students with special needs, such as multi-sensory instruction, social skills training, and positive behavior supports. Next slide, please.
Mr. Enoch, I have a quick question regarding IEPs. For a parent or for a educator to access an IEP, is the student assessed? What is the process of having your student receive or have an access to an IEP?
To access the IEP, the parents can access that IEP at any time, obviously, but in a referral situation, if the parent is not sure if their student requires services, they're referred, they're assessed. If they're assessed and they qualify, they will be provided an IEP that provides FAPE in the areas that they qualify. Does that answer the question?
That does. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have another question from Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Enoch, for joining us today. I'm wondering about the typical caseload for a special education teacher around the state. About how many IEPs would a special education teacher, what's a recommended level for, let's say, K-5 and then 6-12? What's the typical recommended caseload for those teachers?
This is a great question that we, through the chair, this is a great question we get asked every year by teachers in the field. It's very hard to nail down because it really relates more to the teacher's experience, the caseload of the individual students, and if they have intensive need students, and if they have paraprofessional supports. So those variables make it hard to determine. I can give you a ballpark number. My first year in education, I had a caseload of 36, which was considered excessive. I would say something in the 20s would be reasonable for a K through 5 teacher. And depending on the load that a teacher would have for higher grades, that could go up significantly because there's a lot less time directly with the special ed teacher and a lot more time in the regular education classroom. So that class load could go up more because there's less actual student to teacher time directly with the special ed teacher. That could be as high as 30. Those numbers are high by other state standards.
Yes, sir. They are very high. And as a teacher, Madam Chair, if I can follow up,
Senator Bjorkman.
Yeah, with direct experience, I would say that those are very high, and it's surprising to hear that would be a recommendation from the department on those numbers based on classroom experience and lived experience that I have in the field. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Mr. Enoch, just so I can wrap my brain around this and ensure that that folks who are listening understand as well, if you suspect that your child needs an IEP, how would you go about getting referral or access to one?
Any student can be referred for special education assessment by anyone, including teachers, family members. Other students could actually make a comment to the teacher saying they think the student is struggling, and they could pass that on to the teacher. But typically, contacting the school special education teacher is the most direct way.
Thank you very much. Seeing no other questions, please continue.
Next slide, please. This is slide 11. Some students may need more specific services, and these are the students that a caseload would be dramatically shorter for because of the amount of work involved. Students, for example, that are deaf, blind, have autism, or multiple disabilities can be extremely challenging for a teacher with limited experience. However, we do have CESA, and that's the Special Education Service Agency, who provides support for low-incident disabilities such as those. CESA will provide training and assistance to district staff to assist them in writing IEPs and developing programs that meet the requirements of state and federal law. Next slide, please. And there is our contact information. If anyone has any other questions, though, I'd be happy to.
Well, I very much appreciate this presentation. I'm looking around to see if there's any questions from committee members. Senator Bjorkman.
I just have a few comments, Madam Chair. As we look at the the practice of special education in our state and what we do with students who have IEPs, and then to some extent the 504s, based on this would be a different way of providing accommodations to students that might have a learning disability or other physical impairment that might affect how they learn. The caseload numbers that the folks have that administer those IEPs are especially important in the outcomes that students that require special education are able to achieve. And as we look at the amount of mainstreaming into a general ed classrooms that it is currently done in many schools across the state with children who have IEPs, I think we really need to take a hard look at whether or not schools across the state are indeed placing students in their least restrictive learning environment, in an environment that maximizes each student's potential to learn. Because what I can tell you that when we have a focus of putting special education students as much as we can, meaning physically can, not as much as we should based on resources that should be available to students to provide for a least restrictive learning environment based on smaller working groups, smaller sizes, increased amount of time that would be possible with a special education teacher if they had a smaller caseload, you not only impact learning outcomes of students with IEPs and really needing special ed services, but you also impact the learning outcomes of the kids in the general education classroom as well. Class sizes around the state have increased substantially. They were large before 2015 and 2017 when we saw massive reductions to education funding around the state due to inflation and due to other factors. And as we look at how we are educating students, you cannot get around the fact that outcomes are getting worse as we continue to do what we have always done with special education in the state. You cannot possibly have caseloads the size of which you are recommending and expect to have good outcomes. You would have to have immense support that just doesn't exist in any kind of reasonable fashion. And as you have teachers that are special education educators in this state that turn over very, very rapidly, you don't have the expertise on the ground and in classrooms to provide for a capacity to handle those kind of numbers. And when you do, those teachers burn out even faster. And they are seeking actively to get rid of their special education certification so that they don't have to teach special ed anymore. We cannot keep plowing through tomorrows and expect different results. We can't do it. And so as we go forward, I would encourage the department and schools around the state to take a look at, well, how we handle special education and take a hard look at how much mainstreaming that we are doing with kids. And I would say we could get a lot better outcomes if we focus on teaching kids in small groups, in small settings, with their ability-like groups, and I think we could get a lot better bang for our buck there, and we could really seek to improve outcomes, both in special education as well as a general education setting. So those are my comments, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. Any comments, Mr. Enoch, before we wrap up?
Yes, I would just like to clarify, I might have misspoken. We don't make a recommendation as to those caseloads. That estimate number would be the highest in a utopian situation that a teacher with several years' experience and qualified staff assisting them would be able to handle. I don't think those numbers are realistic of success.
Thank you, sir. I do have one last follow-up I'd love to receive from the department. I see several references to state and federal regulation regarding special education services provided. I'd love to have a list of those different U.S. codes, or if those are different state statutes, or even if there is a regulatory booklet that you might be able to provide. I'm very curious, as we continue to have these conversations about correspondence funding and just providing the best services to all students, to know that we are providing it in a framework that is accessible and that we are meeting the obligations that we have put forth in statute or in regulation to ensure the best outcomes for everyone. With that being said, I see no other questions from committee members. I'm going to conclude our agenda for today. So thank you again for joining us. I very much appreciate the presentation and the information, and I'm sure you'll hear from us as we continue to follow up so we can make sure that everyone's getting an excellent education every day. With that, our next meeting of the Senate Education Committee will be on Wednesday, April 19th. I am going to talk this up because I think it's going to be the most titillating and exciting presentation that we will receive in Senate Education all year. And it is from a report called Teachers Like Us, Strategies for Increasing Educator Diversity. I am very excited about this presentation. We also will not be meeting on Friday, April 21st. As there is no other business before us today, the Senate Education Committee adjourns at 4:21 p.m.